importance in the nation. Now, I'll drop that. I think that point is something that we must always remember, though, not ever get away from it. One of the more interesting features of the Section 8, of course, is the Section 11. We often hear people say, well, these are our minerals. These are ours. We should not let anybody take them, let them get enough money to pay for the extraction, and that's it. That, of course, is not what is written into our Constitution. Our Constitution follows the old U.S. law, which was developed largely from the Spanish law. And it states, discovery and appropriation shall be the basis for establishing a right in those minerals reserved to the state. Now, we've seen in Congress various bills to change the mining law. Patsy Mink's bad dream, of course, is, I hope, is buried now, where the thought is that, no, discovery is not important. Well, for the life of me, I cannot see what value any mineral deposit has until somebody finds it. If you aren't going to reward the finder, why should you reward anybody? Now, I think that that particular Section 11 is essential. There may be other changes, but the point is that under the authority that was granted to the legislature by the Constitution, largely Section 11, there has been developed land laws relating to mineral rights that are good, that can lead to the development of this country as it should be. There are plenty of authority for restrictions, requirements that the land not be damaged. We don't have to change the Constitution in that respect, but we must not ever let anyone talk us into the idea that Patsy Mink had a good idea. Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck. To be a Commissioner of Natural Resources in Alaska since 1968 has been, if nothing else, an interesting job, and you never lack for things to do, and it's a good thing that Guy Martin is still young and vigorous, because he certainly does not lack for things to do as our present Commissioner of Natural Resources. So, Guy, it's all yours.
Thanks, Walt. I think, like some of the others on the panel, I took the assignment to come here today seriously, but started, with the exception probably of maybe Walt and a couple of the others, rather cold on the issue, and probably didn't have as much time to spend on the topic as I would have liked to. I did want to make at least some contribution to the scholarship that some of the gentlemen here are evidencing. And one of the things I did do that was quite interesting for me in trying to consider what they intended when they wrote this Constitution was to try to answer the question, did the people at the convention really have a different vision for what they wanted in Alaska as opposed to the vision that others had as they wrote the constitutions of other comparable states, and admitting just for the second that there are states that are at least comparable to Alaska, I looked at least briefly at the constitutions of several other states that I would say are reasonably comparable, mostly western states, large states where at the time of statehood, great amounts of the land were federal, little of the land was private, and a great part of the land went over to the state government, or was intended to go over to the state government. States like Colorado and Nevada, Wyoming, Utah, and others. And my own reading of Alaska history is clearly that people did have a different vision here, and did feel that they had an opportunity to do something different than was being done even in some of the other western states. But I think that in spite of that feeling, in which I have some belief, that different vision is certainly not translated in our Constitution. Although overall our Constitution is a document, I think, of some substantial integrity, there is very little that's new, very little that's visionary, very little that is clearly distinct from what other states did, other similarly situated states did, as they put together their constitutions with respect to natural resources. Now, that's not by itself a condemnation. In fact, in many cases, other Western states similarly situated recognize some of the problems that our framers did. But there's very little evidence in this comparison of an attempt on the part of our framers to structure and provide a constitutional system with regard to our resources, which is different from the system put together by the framers of the constitutions of other comparable states. Now, in reading the Constitution, I found a number of the same impressions that others on this panel did, and since a number of them have been raised, I don't want to repeat as many as have been raised overall, but I would hit just some that stand out to me in looking through our Constitution. One, I agree, I think, with several of the panelists in that the clear orientation of the Constitution is toward settlement and development. It says it at the beginning, and it says it in various ways throughout the document, that the goal was to attempt to settle and develop Alaska, again, to the maximum amount consistent with the public interest. Again, the idea of setting the goal but providing some sort of a check on it for future legislators and future public citizens to exercise. I don't object to that as a goal set out constitutionally, but it appears to be a predominant goal without any built-in statement of alternative values in the document itself. The alternative values, whatever they may be, whatever the public interest was, whatever was consistent with the public interest, was certainly left to later definition, where the primary objective of settlement and development was not. Again, I think that the idea of sustained yield, the replenishable resources, was a strong orientation of the framers. And looking over the history since the Constitution, I think that the concept is held up, but we've probably not sharpened our tools to use the concept particularly well, so that even though we intend to apply it, I don't think we can yet say that we have a full understanding of what replenishment or what a sustained yield is in all the many resource areas that we have, so that we're still carrying out a good and I think very valid concept, but we may not be doing it as well as we should. I think that the multiple use concept is extremely strong in this Constitution. They call it concurrent use most times in this document, and do so because, as I understand it, they wish to express the idea that many things could be going on beneficially at one time with respect to resources in a certain land area. It's not clear, however, in the Constitution, and I'm not sure that we've made clear during the intervening years what the multiple use mix is. It's the old line about it doesn't matter how long the list of multiple uses is, what's important is the use that's at the top. What is the dominant use as opposed to how many uses are in the list? And I'm not sure yet that we faced up to what that term actually means, and I've heard it in many contexts during my tenure as a justification by people on both sides of an issue. It becomes a bit of a tennis ball, a justification for a number of things. I'm not sure yet we know what that means. I think that there's a strong trend in this Constitution toward unified management of natural resources. I think that the people that put it together understood that all of our resources should be treated basically from a unified standpoint. The only one clearly broken out, I think, was fish and game. And I think that, quite frankly, we've done rather well in that over the years, in spite of a number of very substantial pressures, Alaska has been able to resist the evolutionary process that's taken place in other states where the resources are broken out into many, many separate resource categories with separate agencies administering them and becoming subject to constituencies that are interested most in those resources. We've maintained a unified system. And my conversations with resource managers in other states tells me that we are envied for having done that. Another trend that no one's mentioned yet that I would mention, and this comes not only from a reading of the natural resources section article, but a reading of the whole Constitution, is I think a lack of awareness of the fact that there was a pre-existing culture in Alaska prior to the time that the Constitution was written, or prior to the time that the United States was a full-time territorial resident of Alaska. I get a flavor which I can't describe much further than that, that what was attempted here was the construction of a government, a society, on top of, rather than in interrelationship with, the pre-existing native culture that was in the state. And not only in the natural resources article, but in some of the others, there's, I think, a lack of awareness that there was a substantial interest in Alaska, a substantial resident interest, prior to the time that this society was established. I know that, and of course it was well argued in the Native Land Claims litigation, that there was a recognition of this in all of the important documents, the Organic Act and so on. But that recognition, let's say, is not a strong one in the Constitution. And finally, I guess I'd say that I recognize a tremendous unevenness in the resource article, probably along the lines that Jim Hurley described, in that certain areas, such as fisheries and minerals, obviously because they were important at the time, received substantially greater attention than other resource values or resource commodities, which were not suspected to be so great in Alaska's future. Evidence of that, of course, is the article that Chuck talked about with regard to the system for minerals. That language is almost statutory rather than constitutional in nature, whereas it is immediately followed by a rather general constitutional statement with regard to leasable minerals, obviously contemplating oil and gas, which is certainly not statutory. Now, Jim will have to help us as to whether or not that was intentional or an oversight, or whether or not it was a function of the fact that mineral interests were at the time so well known and so well represented at the convention that they were able to write almost statutory language. Now, just pressing on for a second, I tried to think what sorts of things, without having been there, what sorts of things the framers of the Constitution might have been unlikely to see 20 years ago. What sorts of things that we now know they really couldn't have seen and might have missed as they wrote the Constitution. And I suppose you could make a list of 100 things, but three or four, I think, came to mind that I think they may have missed. One is the Settlement Act for the land claims. I think that even as recently as 10 years ago, there was a failure to understand how important that issue was, how large the settlement might be, and what a tremendous relationship that settlement would have on the administration of natural resources in the state. And I find very little evidence in the Constitution that there was a realization that that would occur and occur as it did. I think that it's possible that the framers could well have missed the size, the massiveness of the potential energy development, the potential resource developments that may well come in Alaska over the next couple decades, developments like Prudhoe Bay, developments like the Outer Continental Shelf Program, developments like massive coal fields and perhaps slurry lines, and similar sorts of developments of a size and scale that really force you to rethink all of your concepts of how to deal with resource management. Specific example, the oil tax debates in the legislature, which are framed basically in relationship to Prudhoe Bay oil and gas, as opposed to a long-term oil and gas taxation policy, which may very well be different if we weren't confronted with a massive success as our first attempt out of the box. Still another thing that I think may well have been unanticipated was the effect that the costs of resource development would have on resource development policy in the state. Although I suppose Alaskans even then knew that it was going to be expensive here and that costs were going to be higher in comparison, I think that it would have been difficult for them to see what a major issue the cost of development would be on the development policy with respect to any resource. so that we now, for specific examples, see that only the largest oil and gas finds can ever be expected to be produced in Alaska, where in Kansas or somewhere else they would certainly be produced. We now find that legitimate mining discoveries that could and should be produced can't be produced, with one of the major causes, one of the major detriments of that development being simply the overwhelming costs. And then I suppose we're into a long discussion of what drives those costs. And I guess what I'm saying is that it may well be costs which decide a certain amount of our policy rather than our desires or our even the resource value itself to the people. And then finally, one issue that I want to hit, just a couple challenges, is I think it would have been very difficult for the framers to foresee the nature of the continuing federal role in Alaska. I'm sure that they could see that there was going to be a continuing role, but I doubt if they could have seen the way in which that role would have unfolded. And as I see it, that role is unfolding in a couple of ways. One, it's unfolding in that we thought that the federal presence would probably diminish, although not disappear over the years in Alaska. But in fact, I think that it can safely be said that the federal role is perhaps as strong now as it's ever been in Alaska. It's strong in the sense that they are still withholding from the people of the state, and I include both the native corporations and the state itself, the land and resources which is rightfully theirs under the Native Claims Settlement Act or under the Statehood Act. Still another example of the continuing federal role is the fact that the new major energy programs and development programs, largely federally dominated and taking place on federal lands, have the power to drive our own resource policy and to deprive us of the capability of making independent decisions. This sort of role, I doubt if it could have been fully appreciated. Finally, just four quick items that might be challenges that grow out of all this. One is, I think, a challenge that can certainly be met within the framework of our Constitution, and that is the challenge of designing cooperative structures for resource management, meeting some of these things that were unforeseen by designing resource development, resource management structures, whether it's land, oil and gas, fisheries, or whatever, that are cooperative between the major landowners and governmental interests in the state, including the federal government, the state, the local communities, and now the major landholders, the native corporations. Can we achieve cooperative structures? I would think yes, under the concept of this Constitution. Still another challenge is, and this responds to the unforeseen item of costs, how can we, it's a challenge to see if we can have any role in the future of Alaska for the small resource user who is not a giant corporation, not a Borax, not an ARCO, not a Georgia Pacific, but the resource user who is an individual miner, a small mining concern, a small timber operation, a sawmill as opposed to a massive pulp mill. How can we carve out a role in view of the restrictions that have grown over the past few years for the small resource developer or the individual who wants to own or hold small amounts of land? Still another challenge is simply to cope with the results of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Tim mentioned a couple, and I think he was on target. Such things as subsistence are questions that we simply have to answer. Similarly, the issue of easements. Can we contend with issues like this and with the land patterns that grew out of the Settlement Act, which were simply political as opposed to substantive in terms of their beneficial application to the state? And finally, are we going to be able to settle the state-federal issues? Are we somehow going to be able to reach that period in our history where if the federal government isn't gone, it is at least reduced to a place, a role in the state that the state can understand, the native corporations can understand, and the people of the state can understand and make reliable decisions on? Walt, thank you.
Thank you, Guy. There's an audience out there that contains very many interesting people with a long input to this. Some of the members from the Committee on Resources I see in the audience, a good many other delegates. And luckily, we have plenty of time yet to expand on these issues. 2 hours to be exact. First, or do any of the panel members have anything that they really wish to overwhelmingly bring out at this time before we open it up to general discussion?
Well, I'd like to just suggest to the panelists that they might think about this statement, that really the question when examining the Constitution and whether it has been reasonably successful or not is simply this: has the Constitution interfered with the legislature in its proper role of meeting the requirements of the time? Not what the Constitution has said or has not said that you may agree or disagree with, but has the legislature been able to meet the current needs as they exist from time to time and still do so within the Constitution?
Yeah, I think that's very important to remember.
Was that Chuck?
I think so. I don't think that the legislature's been hampered by any constitutional provisions in Article 8.
Yeah. One point I'd like to make on the point of the failure of the Constitution to recognize Native culture, there was a substantial effort made by at least one individual at that Constitutional Convention to incorporate language in the Constitution, at least recognizing the problem. It was not incorporated, but the effort was made just to set the historical record correct.
Yes, I had the sad experience when I went back to Washington one time with, Governor Miller got together a bunch to try to talk to the Congress about various things, and we were all given assignments to call on certain congressmen, and somehow or other I drew the name of Jim Haley. And it seems that Governor Egan, who was back there then, he was not governor at the time, but Bill Egan was there. We were to call on him together, and Bill knew him, and somehow or other Bill didn't make it, and I walked in cold on Jim Haley and tried to make a little talk. And first of all, he said, "Well, I thought that Bill Egan was going to be here." I said, "Well, he was detained." He said, "Well, what do you want?" And I started to make my speech. He says, "Now look at here. You guys didn't settle that Native Claims Bill before you got statehood, and I was dumb way against it. For 15 minutes, I caught hell." Mm-hmm. So that part, it's too bad that wasn't written into the Constitution at that time.
You know, could I, Walt, respond again? And probably the audience doesn't need challenging anymore, but the question was from Jim Hurley: has the Constitution interfered with either legislative or executive branch in their development of needed, specific, timely, current policies? And the answer that Chuck gave was no, it hasn't. I suppose the amendment for the limited entry was a case where we at least had to change the original document. But if the answer in fact is no, what does that say about the document? Does it say that it is so good that it allowed, it predicted events successfully or predicted needs successfully? Or does it say that the Constitution is so bland that it couldn't get in the way of anybody? For example, it might be analogous to planners and their function in state government. If the question is, have the plans interfered with the activities of government, and the answer is no, then there's two conclusions. The planners have done either a fine job or they've done a bad job, and I'm not sure whether the answer is clear here.
Okay, does anyone from the audience wish to bring anything up now? Colonel Marston?
Does it work? Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Yes.
I've enjoyed the conversation with the panel. I think it's good. But I think we have missed a big issue. And I believe, as you said, that Alaska has a hope for America and its energy and its various elements that we need to run a great nation. I'm farming over here for the Eskimos in North River. I furnished the seed, the fertilizer, and the material, and I bought the land for them. And we produced last year 14,000 pounds of potatoes, cabbage, and turnips, and carrots on an acre and a half, possibly 2 acres of ground. We're going to put 50 acres under cultivation. It goes to the Covenant High School. They're running it. They get the whole product. I want to establish the burst of population that's coming in the world will double in 35 years. There's not enough food to feed them. We'll have to do like your animals, live off each other. Unless we do something about it now. And what's happening, what I'm getting at, the federal government, the President of the United States the other day was out to one of our parks and he said, we're going to double all the parks in the world, in the United States. Because one park was crowded. Right now, we have more parks in Alaska than the rest of the United States put together. And right now, the federal government is planning on putting one third of Alaska locked up in wilderness country. So you can either mine on it, hunt for oil and gas or minerals, or farm on it. Right now, over in Unalakleet Way, there's a lot of fine farmland. On the Yukon, the Kuskokwim, the North River, the Kobuk River, there's areas there that will produce great crops. But there's right now a plan underway by the federal government to put one-third of Alaska under wilderness, so you can't touch anything on it. It's suicide. One time, the defense of Alaska, the defense of the nation, had priority over everything. I hate to say it, but I'm going to say it. Priority now goes to the Sierra Club. No question about it. Somebody, some of you right down there are on that line. We've got to get power, or the Arabs are going to get us. I think we have enough power. I hope we can find a dozen Bruto Bay fields under this frozen ground up here. It's possible. But right now, they're trying to lock up, and will in the next few years, lock up one-third of Alaska in the wilderness country, so you can't mine, farm it, or do anything with it. And I think that's a big issue before Alaska today. And we are only 300,000 population, and we can't influence the federal government. We have no power. I'll tell you how we did it on statehood. We had a man in Congress down there, a congressman, I forget his name now, who stopped us from getting through the statehood measure. He blocked it. He had that power. And there was a Baptist minister on that committee on Operation Statehood. And he says, I've got a letter here I think could move that man. That one man sat down there and held the whole thing. And it was a good letter on that the people of Alaska wanted to be a part of the great union, and it touched the sentimental chords. And he said, I think we can send this to the Baptist ministers of Texas. Well, we said, we'll do that. This man was in the Baptist church. There are 30,000 Baptist churches in Texas, surprising. And we got the letter out, took all of our money we had in the operating statehood to furnish the stamps. But it worked. That man surrendered, and we got the statehood by him. Now, what we can do here in Alaska, we can contact the people outside who have power in Congress to realize what's happening here. Locking up the wealth of Alaska, which is more wealthy than any state in the Union. Farmland, minerals, oil, and gas, so you can never touch it. One third of it now is being considered. And the president said, I'm going to double the parks of the world, of the United States. Can we afford to lose one third of Alaska? locked up forever all winter in this country? No, we cannot. I'm building you a culture on you now. I'm asking a question, I'm making a talk. I think it's very serious that we should consider this thing. First measure is to stop this locking up of one third of Alaska and the wilderness country. That's the first mission, that's the first thing we've got. And I hope you'll think over that. And I hope we can do it. And we can do it by getting to the people outside and telling the importance of keeping this ground open for oil and gas and mineral and farming. That's all I got to say. That's the first question before the people of Alaska today. I wish you'd consider that and see if we can. That and see if we can't get onto that deal like we did on statehood. We went gung-ho on statehood. I made three trips down to Washington, D.C. in chartered planes, made our own way down there. We talked to the people in the streets and in their offices. And to save Alaska from being locked up, Congress will have it in the next 3 or 4 years, they'll make a decision. And right now they've got the inroad down there. The Sierra Club is locking us up. It shouldn't be that way. Let's save Alaska. Let's not let them lock up Alaska. Now, Willie Hensley touched on that last night. I think our Native organizations are going to go along with us. I know they're going to. They're going to come all right. I'm happy they got 40 million acres of ground. That's in private hands now, not in the federal government. And that's good. The more land we get into private hands or under the control of the state of Alaska, the better. That's all I got to say. That's the end of my talk.
Thank you, Colonel. And the Congress will be taking up those lands in the next 2 years, and a good many people in this room, of course, are going to be heavily involved in that particular discussion. Does anybody on the panel have anything they want to say?
No, but I think we ought to thank Colonel Marston for reminding us that agriculture is a very strong possibility for this state to take its place in the nation in that respect, too. I think the University of Alaska has done some wonderful work on research and picking land and showing crops that can be grown in this country profitably today, in spite of the high costs that our commissioner points out. It is a thing that can be started, and I hope it will. But, of course, even the agriculture, again, as the university points out, is badly damaged by some of the proposals for withdrawing land.
I might just say, Colonel, that we're developing some figures now that try to analyze the land that the state already holds. In other words, we know the land that we've selected, and to try to analyze what that portfolio is like, think of it as a stock portfolio, how strong are we in agriculture? And it's sort of interesting to see, the figures aren't complete yet and they're still being researched, but it's interesting to see what it was that drove our former land selections. Are we strong in minerals, strong in agriculture, strong in timber, strong in community land, so on? And it turns out, it looks as if it's going to turn out, that the state of Alaska holds quite strongly in the agricultural area. I can't recall the exact figures now, but taking a statewide look and identifying all of the agricultural potential land. And as I recall it, picking the best third of all agricultural land in Alaska, and you've heard this figure, it's somewhere between 14 and 18 million acres that are considered to be viable to some extent for agriculture. Now, this is viable talking about only soil and water and so on, but it doesn't talk about transportation or costs or so on. But of the top third of that land, Alaska owns very close to half of it, and we also have laws now, pursuant to our Constitution, which allow, and pursuant to the action of the last legislature, again, going to Jim's question of can we do the things we need to do under this Constitution, the last legislature passed a law which allows the state to give only agricultural title to land. That was a bill that was supported by both the legislature and the administration, and this is a key factor in holding costs down. Because if you convey only agricultural title, you've obviously frustrated speculation, and you've made agriculture the prime use on that land. so that I have a feeling that if you're going to address this cost issue, that that's the way to do it, and that if agriculture can become viable on again, some very, quite a great deal of state land held that has good agricultural potential, this is about the time it ought to start happening, because we've got a law that allows us to give only agricultural title. We hold a lot of good agricultural land, and I think there's a rising tide of interest in agriculture in Alaska. So it'll be interesting to see now if the interest can overcome some of the obstacles and hurdles and get into production.
Okay, thank you, Guy. Mr. Boswell?
I was a member of the Resources Committee, and somebody mentioned the sustained yield principle, and I want to question that again. I live in Oregon now, have for 11 years, and we have clear cutting. It's Sierra Club's against that too, but it's clear cutting of these timber lands, and then they can grow up again. If they clear cut it, everything goes, and in 50 more years, that's replenishable. So I think there is something to the sustained yield principle, just like that, and maybe it could be apply in other cases. We heard about this, I don't know what the name of it is, when the natives began claiming this land, and they took, it seemed like they were going to take all the navigable waters and rivers and so forth. I don't know, was there anything to that? Is it correct, or was it? I don't know.
Navigable waters were left out.
Sir?
Navigable waters were left out. Uh-huh.
Well, we have this, Section 14 covers that in the resources, and I think that's about all I have to say.
Yeah.
The navigable waters issue is certainly certainly one of the pieces of homework that hasn't been done, and I think it's both characteristic of the inability of the state to be able to get the answers it needs from the federal government and to resolve that relationship. But I think it's also probably a strong point in the Constitution. I think that section and what it represents in terms of guidance is a little different than some of the other things. There is some strong guidance provided there, and that's been pursued with different amounts of aggressiveness by the state over the years. But it's simply another instance of the state being unable to resolve a very important issue with the Department of Interior. Chuck here can probably tell you that a couple years ago, about 3 or 4 years ago, we attempted to resolve that with the federal government by submitting to them a proposal with regard to navigable waters, which they, I think it's best to say, just refused to work to act on.
Well, they agreed verbally and then disagreed.
Could I... since I'm the only known Sierra Clubber on the panel, although there may be others who aren't letting it be known, let me say, just by very quick comment, that in the 1950s, when the framers of the Constitution were at their work, as Chuck mentioned earlier, mineral production was at a very low ebb. The fisheries were in extremely sad straits. The state was not certain at all whether the military presence would begin to wane and we would lose that source of our economy. Things weren't all that great in terms of economic activity. And at the same time, of course, there weren't very many parks or proposed parks in the state. Right now, we've got, perhaps as Colonel Marson was put it, we're threatened with having a third of our land locked up. And our economic activity has reached a peak that I personally call frantic, and it certainly must bring joy to the heart of every developer in the state. If that's the general relationship, I guess the Sierra Club had better not expand its proposals or we'll have all hell break loose in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. One other thing, W.O. Smith, the fisherman, was responsible for Section 15 no exclusive right or special privilege of fishery shall be created or authorized in the natural waters of the state. And then it was amended, another sentence added. But we also had ordinance number 3, abolition of fish traps. On when people voted for that, when they voted for the ratify the Constitution. So we did cut out the fish traps. That's why R.E. Robertson didn't sign the Constitution. I think maybe that's about all I have to say. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Who do we have?
Yeah, you're first, and the lady in the room.
Chairman Parker, distinguished members of the panel, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Tom Smith. I'm a Fairbanks-based geological consultant. And responding to Mr. Parker's opening remarks, I too am especially impressed with the comprehensive nature of Article 8 dealing with natural resources in Alaska. I think the language of the various sections under Article 8 show a very perceptive future view of what is now, what is Alaska's current emerging role as a key state in natural resource in the resource picture. Particularly in energy and minerals, non-renewable resources. I would add that, Walt, that mining is still dormant in Alaska. At one time, there was some mining. It's still dormant today for the most part. Professor Whedon has just mentioned the point that we at one time we were on a federal handout system, and our very livelihood, our sustenance, our subsistence was dependent between the robber baron era and the environmental era on federal handouts. And I think you'll all agree that the natural resources of Alaska, the non-renewable natural resources, particularly oil and gas, have largely relieved our dependence on these federal payrolls. And of course, to a large extent, this is due to the diligent efforts and management capability of Commissioner Herbert and Governor Egan. So there was that interim period where we fed from the government handout system. We're now relieved from that. At the present time, I think there's much less recognition of the intent of Article 8. And we see this probably in a number of ways. Quite properly, for each section of Article 8, there's a flurry of legislation that's followed Article 8, addressing the use, development, conservation, et cetera, of resources. But now, sadly, and I suppose less properly, there's a veritable blizzard, not a flurry, but a blizzard of agency interpretation concerning the implementation of the legislation, which harkened on back to the Article 8 itself. Tragically, it seems that in many cases it's the agency interpretation that is being implemented. And this, of course, becomes a de facto regulation, a regulation that was perhaps not thought of by our elected representatives or the framers of the Constitution. I was looking at an example of this morning. I have a citation from an agency in which 40 words from one of the acts were amplified 82 times into 3,300 words, and the agency is implementing the 3,300 words. This is happening to us both in the state and federal arena. I suppose one answer to this is still more legislation of the sort known as sunset legislation. I think that my comments here may duplicate to some extent Commissioner Herbert's remarks. However, repetition is sometimes an effective teaching technique, and so I'm going to say it again anyway. My immediate concern is how we can face and accommodate the very real fact that our nation, in fact our world, is passing from an era of surplus to an era of shortage, generally because there are more of us. This is the problem we perhaps should attack, the fact there are too many of us, but this surplus to shortage is a very real thing we have to address. And furthermore, Alaska will have to play a very key part in solving this crisis or coming up with some sort of a solution to it. I fully concur with Professor Whedon's thoughts that that we're a product of our times, we live in our times. I live in 1976, and so do you. And in a parallel way, that Alaska is a part of the nation. We cannot escape from this fact. And moreover, Alaska is only going to own about a third of Alaska's land, or a little bit less. Well, today the most important thing we face as a nation, and Alaska's part of that, is how to meet the country's present and future energy and mineral needs. The uncertainties with foreign sources have clearly indicated a need for caution and over-reliance on other nations for vital commodities. How can we meet these needs? What are we going to do about it? In general, we'll have to utilize the resources which exist in large part on public lands and to a lesser part on private lands. The public lands are the areas where we have to search for new commodities. And the state administration legislators are going to have to address this in Alaska. Alaska is one of the few undeveloped parts of the United States where we can go look for new commodities. The long lead times and the high capital investments required to identify and develop any mineral resources require that we have a solid, a dependable, a consistent energy and resource policy, something that the investor, you and I, who own stocks, can depend upon. I submit today in Alaska we don't have that. We need a resource policy which is insulated from the whims of political expediency. I submit we do not have that. And a corollary of this, I guess I would address to Chairman Parker, is that a very real need for a sound, stable policy on transportation corridors. Perhaps an amendment to the Constitution incorporating such concepts as are contained in Section 14, which addresses the navigable waters. And so in the face of Alaska's and the nation's needs, as we move into the 1980s, I direct the question to you, gentlemen. Can we refute the commentary of my corporate clients who accuse us of running a banana republic up here? Can the diverse constituencies in Alaska work together toward a stable, comprehensive resource policy? Do you think it'll require a revision of the Constitution, or can we weed out the agencies and the legislative underbrush and return to Article 8 that's on the books? It seems to me the time is here, right now. Can we rise to the challenge and solve it now? Or are we going to remain in polarized advocacy groups, as we have for the past few years? Now, advocacy groups are interesting critters. I think you'll agree they serve a very vital function. But the odd thing about them is they never know when to quit. Once they've made their point, they can't retreat back to anything that's understandable. They felt the might of power, and they keep on going until finally somebody beheads them. Well, can we behave more intelligently as we move into the 80s? Can we retreat away from this polarized camp approach and attempt to make some solution to this? Certainly, that approach is counterproductive. I don't think there's a soul in this room who would disagree with that. So these are the questions I direct to you, gentlemen, and I hope there'll be time for a little response. Could Commissioner Martin begin the response to these questions?
Well, I think, Tom, you echoed a number of the things I said at the end in terms of the challenges to be met. I was talking about, I guess, exactly the same kind of things you are. Design of cooperative systems is exactly the sort of thing I mean. I can't recall the entire list, but basically speaking, I think that you raise a good point. It's hard to know what the source of dissension is. I know that when I was doing some of the research leading up to today, I found the following comment. Let me read this to you. It's sort of interesting. This moment will be a critical one, and Alaska's future history. Development must not be confused with exploitation. The financial welfare of the future and the well-being of the present and unborn citizens of the future state depend upon the wise administration and oversight of these developmental activities. Very real dangers are present. The first and most obvious danger is that of exploitation under the thin disguise of development. The taking of Alaska's mineral resources without leaving some reasonable return for the support of Alaska governmental services and the use of all the people in Alaska will mean a betrayal in the administration of the people's wealth. Kind of interesting remarks. Bob Bartlett. And I think it, if you read his entire address that he gave at the Constitutional Convention as the preliminary speech, the keynote speech, he hit a lot of the themes that you just hit. Now, I guess I'd have to say that, and I'm not sure whether I'm differing with you or not, that it seems to me that you can still make the statement that the Constitution is not creating any hindrance to what you want to accomplish. You're arguing to get back to it. And it seems to me that you've got to use the system of representative government to do that. And it seems to me that the legislature, the executive branch, is a place that's got to start. Now, I may be more affirmative than you are about what the accomplishments of the last, let's say, 6 years or so in the legislature have been. But it seems to me that in view of the really phenomenal things that have happened in this state, starting with the Settlement Act, essentially the federal energy program, the entire issue with respect to land allocation in Alaska, that without making an all-purpose defense of one administration versus another, going all the way back past the last Egan administration, I'm just not sure that you can make out a case to castigate all those legislators or administrators during that period. And in fact, it seems to me that in the face of some unbelievably complex problems, and I understand this when I talk to people from other states who don't face one problem of the magnitude that we face 30 of, that basically there's been quite a bit of constructive progress made. So I'm not sure if that responds fully to what you said. It's you made a general statement, of mine is general, but it seems to me that all the vehicles are there to do exactly what you're advocating.
And I think what I need to hear from you, Tom, is are you saying that in securing a long-term resource policy that you want that enshrined in the Constitution so that the lease policy and other such things are not subject to the political process? I think that would be something that would certainly occasion a great deal of debate.
No, I'm a great admirer of the political process, and I guess where my real feelings begin to come into view is where the words of our elected representatives, who can periodically turn over in response to the need as it exists at that time, when their words are taken and amplified, when very distinct and clear language is amplified and embellished. This is what I think is probably something we should avoid, because then it's removed from the elected representatives of the people. So I concur certainly with your thought there, but let's not take it that one step beyond.
But I guess that the sections 10, 11, and 12, I don't perceive them as inhibiting policy development, particularly at this time. And anybody else want to?
Could I make just one last comment? You did have a thought in the middle of your comment that I thought is really a good one, Tom. And it's just a single issue, and that is a sunset law idea. And you tied it to the idea, I think you were talking about regulations. And it seems to me that even taking my defense that all the ingredients are there to make this thing work, I think we could do some things to deal with this regulatory problem on the one hand. And as you know, it's a very perverse problem, because in certain areas we have way too many regulations and they're unchecked. In other key areas, we have a lengthy history in the state of Alaska having no regulations at all in areas where we badly need them. And I think that something in that process may be important. For instance, at least consideration of the idea to require approval of regulations as opposed to letting them go into effect by acquiescence. On the sunset law idea, it seems to me that there's a lot of advantages to something like that. I've looked at it as Florida, I think, was the first to have that sort of law. And a kind of a middle ground to move toward a sunset law is to make sure that any new programs that we establish in the legislature are established with a lifetime and give things a lifetime so that we can gauge their effectiveness. And whether it's a 5-year life or a 10-year life, make the legislature at the time reenact those programs if they like them. And if they don't like them, let them die a natural death. But the idea of it's a much bigger step to go back and end all the programs now.
We have a point of commonality here today. Yeah, I agree. Why don't we sit down and work something out?
Okay. The lady in blue suit is next.
My name is Ada Wien, and I was the only woman member of the resources article. Probably the one that had the least specialization in resources. But I was born in Nome. My father was one of the gold seekers in the gold rush. Very proud of my pioneer heritage, not only in the pioneering of Alaska, but in aviation. And I'm not going to give a very learned talk, but rather in defense of the members of the Resources Committee. I'd like to point out that it was the first resources article that was ever written in a state constitution, and I think we should be given great credit for that. It was also the committee that had held more hearings than any other committee. And I, as the more, I will say, unlearned in resources on the committee, was impressed by the presentations that were made to us by the various interests and the open-mindedness of the members on the committee to back off and look at it and put things in balance. I just wanted to make that speech in defense of the Resources Committee. I wanted to make another remark where the remark was made that we were not looking to the future so much, but rather thinking of the past. And I heartily disagree with that. It was a committee that was looking to the future, but if we were influenced by anything, it was probably because we had lived in a long era of paternalism from the United States government without representation. And true enough, I don't believe that we realized the extent of the native land claims and what it would do on to the resources. But we were aware, and we listened to a lot of testimony. We had an excellent paper on Aboriginal rights, and we were aware of it. But as the representative of the Native Corporation stated, when the Constitution was written, even they were totally unaware of it. So we were all babes in that respect. But I think that it was more the paternalism rather than ignorance that made us do many things. And in reference to the word "its," I think perhaps our thinking was we had had so little control. And I have never known Alaskans to not do anything for themselves, and I hope it will continue in future generations, to benefit the people of Alaska to the detriment of the rest of the United States. And I think that Alaskans should have control of their resources. I approve of the ITS because I feel confident that Alaskans, any time that they do it for the good of the people, they will be doing it and be far ahead in thinking of the good of the rest of the country. Let me look a minute at some of my other notes. We also were certainly unaware of inflation and what the cost of mineral development would do to Alaska, but not unaware of what it would be. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mrs. Wien. I think those are important points to make in giving perspective to all of us. Take us back to that time when we were all a lot younger and we all solidly supported fish trap abolition. I think that was, you know, to a man, the people of the state were for that, except for the people who owned the fish traps in the federal government. And what getting rid of the fish traps led us into, of course, was a proliferation of the fishing fleets, which got us to limited entry. But that doesn't mean that the original stand was bad, that, you know, that the fish traps were good. It's just that nothing stays still in this world. Mr. Boswell?
Well, I wanted to ask one question. I heard the term robber barons. I was with the U.S. Building Company for 40 years after graduating from university, and I wondered if we were classed that way when we came in here, worked on drifted ground, mainly gold had already been taken out, and put our dredges on it, and got the rest of it. And I wouldn't say that we were robber barons. We had to send the gold out and pay some off some to our stockholders, but that was one thing that I wanted to mention. And I kind of got the impression from some people that there hadn't been any mining for a long time, that we were here for 40 years.
I wonder, Jack, if the University of Alaska would be what it is today if it were not for the dredges that started up here.
Well, yes. And what would Fairbanks be today? It was about 1,500 people, I think, when we started. And we, our payroll, our crews, amounted to about 600 people per year in the summertime.
This gentleman has an observation.
Mr. Chairman, McCutcheon. Steve McCutcheon speaking. I was a member of the Constitutional Convention. I was rather interested in Mr. Martin's remarks. And the question I have to ask you is, what relevancy does the cost of production have to the document that we have under consideration? It seems to me that the remarks have been going forth and back. You're completely and absolutely in the legislative area, not in a constitutional area.